Hi, I'm Mike Wett, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. On September 18th, HBO, New York University, and ProPublica co-sponsored an event titled Turning Real Life into Real Life. The conversation featured David Simon, the creator of the acclaimed HBO drama The Wire, and the creator and co-executive producer of Tremé. He's joined by his Tremé co-creator and co-executive producer, Eric Overmeyer. Award-winning ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson was on the panel as well. And Joe Piccirillo, the chair of NYU's undergraduate film and TV program, moderated the event. The group talked about the details of Thompson's original investigation and how Simon and Overmeyer turned Thompson and his reporting into a new storyline on Tremé as the new character L.P. Everett. The podcast features excerpts from that discussion. We start with Thompson summarizing his original investigation.
I work for ProPublica, which is an investigative journalism nonprofit, like my boss Steve said. And back in 2007, I was tipped off by a historian, a friend of mine, who was working on a book about disasters. And she was in New Orleans, and she said, "Hey, I got this tip that there were these racially motivated attacks in the wake of Hurricane Katrina." And she said, "I'm not an investigative reporter, but you are, and you can figure out whether this really happened or not." And so I went down in the summer of 2007. I was a freelancer at the time. I got support from the Nation Institute, which is a journalism nonprofit. Other journalism nonprofits kicked in as well and started supporting me. And I went to look to see if there was any truth to this. And as I started reporting and started digging and started looking for facts and corroboration or facts that disproved these allegations, I realized that I had encountered a scenario that was pretty similar to what you saw there, that I realized I had stepped into an alternate universe in some ways. And what I found was, yeah, there were racially motivated attacks in one predominantly white neighborhood on the West Bank of New Orleans, where white men took up arms and attacked African-American men who were fleeing the storm, and that happened. One of those people, as a result of my reporting, as a result of the federal government's paying attention to that reporting and very aggressively prosecuting, is going on trial in December of this year for federal hate crimes for shooting somebody at point-blank range with a shotgun, allegedly. But as I was doing, I said, allegedly, I don't know for sure. That's the allegation. It's in court documents. That's what my reporting suggested as well. That's what his mother actually suggested to me on the phone as well. That's the allegation. No, this is not the Glover case, but this is what led me to the Glover case. And as I was investigating that thread and that story, which is alluded to in the clip you saw, the vigilante attacks, I had a friend who said, "I don't know what this is, and I don't know how it ties into what you're looking at, but I've got this document, and it's a document about a body that supposedly got burned up on the West Bank, not far from these attacks that you're talking about, and supposedly the police were involved, and supposedly the guy who died's name is Henry Glover, and the document I have is this short interview statement that was given by a gentleman to a local police watchdog group, a nonprofit police watchdog group." And my friend said, "You should check this out. It's kind of weird. I don't know really what it means, if it has any connection to what you're looking at, but you should check it out." And the story was, as I reported it out, and as I went along, was shortly after the storm made landfall, the New Orleans police did in fact shoot a man named Henry Glover on the West Bank of New Orleans. They killed him. They shot him, and as he was going to get assistance and get medical help and try to survive, as people were trying to rescue him, they unwittingly took him to another police outpost, to a school where the SWAT team was camped out. And the SWAT team officers who were there at that point proceeded to allegedly physically attack the people who were trying to rescue this gentleman who'd been shot with an assault rifle by another cop, and let him bleed to death in the back seat of the car that they were trying to rescue him in. The police, and now this is not alleged, this is absolutely true, then definitely drove his body to the Mississippi River and set it on fire and burnt it up and didn't tell anybody at all for years about the fact that they had murdered a guy and burnt up his body and left nothing but bone fragments and ashes and charred flesh. And that was the story that I stumbled into from my initial investigation of the vigilante attacks through this weird tip that turned out to actually be a really incredible and powerful story. So that's how I got into this. And that was Henry Glover, who was killed.
Wasn't there a point where somebody may have, high up in the police, because the question becomes, why were they doing this? Was there a sense that the city had lost control of itself and the police were asked to recapture the city and go after looters? And I mean, can you talk about the sort of, what was the backdrop for these killings?
The backdrop here, and what's important to understand is that 10 civilians were shot by New Orleans police officers in the days immediately following the storm, and Henry Glover was one of those 10. What was going on that we found through our reporting was there was one, a police officer who'd been shot on the West Bank, who had been shot in the head in an attack by civilians, and so police officers were disturbed by that. They were freaked out by that. They were scared. There was a total breakdown of communications. There, in many ways, there was no normal radio system. There was no normal chain of command. The police force had devolved into basically roving groups of officers who were passing messages through word of mouth. And one message that got passed word of mouth was, the mayor's declared martial law, and we're going to take back the city by any means necessary. And if you need to shoot looters, regardless of whether they pose a threat to anyone, you should go ahead and do that. And that's there is a videotape of a police captain making that statement, saying, go out and shoot looters if you need to. And so that's a thing that multiple officers told us was a theme that they had heard. And this was very murky for many of them. They didn't know exactly what this meant. Take the city back, shoot looters. What does this mean? But there was this sort of murkiness out there and this sort of sense that, hey, we've got to do whatever it takes to regain control of the city. And from that, I believe, sprang some of these shootings and some of these acts, that sort of sense that the officers had at that point.
I can't resist this question. The reporters cited me. Was there a particular police officer or source who ultimately said, without getting too deep in this, how did you determine to the sufficient to print it that the police burned his body and killed him?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? Yeah, that took a long time to get through the lawyers and the editors. Actually, certain other things took longer. The initial story that we did that was published by The Nation magazine and published on the ProPublica website didn't say the police killed this guy. It was journalism that said, look, these are the clues that we have. The last time anybody who will talk saw him, he was in the custody of the police and he had been shot. And we're not sure exactly what happened. What we know is the last time anyone saw him, he was in the custody of the police. The next time anyone saw him, he was bones and ashes and burnt flesh. And interestingly, that body was found, or those remains, it was not a body, remains of a body were found very, very close to a police station right on the Mississippi River. And the sources that I had within the law enforcement community were suggesting to me that they believed that the police department was involved. And sort of all the evidence pointed that way. And so that's what we said. The initial story didn't conclusively say anything. What the federal courts found was at trial was that, yes, one officer did shoot Henry Glover. Yes, another officer was involved in burning up his body. Yes, a third officer was involved in the cover-up, and they acquitted two officers. And the third officer's conviction has been overturned, and he will be facing a second trial. So that's what the courts have said, and that's what has been factually proven in court. But our story said, these are the facts that we have. Take it from there.
Great job. So now, David and Eric, were you already deciding before you got wind of AC? Because I noticed in the David Morris character, he's going down a trail that I suspect, I could be wrong, is going to intersect with this in some way. Did you already decide to pursue a police killing looters story separately from this, or did this steer you that way? And then what attracted you to AC stuff?
Well, second season, we started a fictional case, but it was really a composite of, suggested by several other cases of civilians being shot by the police after the storm. We had that fictional case going in season two, not resolved by the end of season two, and then we knew that we wanted to pursue one of the real cases as well in parallel, and the Glover case seemed like a good one, and I can't quite remember the sequence of events.
Yeah, I don't remember actually why we settled on the Glover case now. I think it was a pretty stark image, the idea of them burning the body. So I think that may have, you know, it's something profoundly stark about that. Also, the character that we had in second season, who was our protagonist, our fictional protagonist, was a civil rights attorney, played by Melissa Leo, who is based on a real civil rights attorney in New Orleans. And she was actually an attorney for the family in the Danziger Bridge shooting, yet another shooting involving New Orleans police officers at the time of the storm. And so we were on the same sort of logic of trying to depict just how hard it was to get anybody to look back at what had happened during the storm. And it was epic. You know, we actually purposely ended season two without much progress, where she had gotten to the point in the case of actually raising enough interesting evidence that somebody should have picked up the ball and run with it if you had a legitimate investigative function to your law enforcement. And New Orleans didn't have that. You know, the New Orleans Police Department was not inclined to investigate itself or to look back at what it had done during the storm. And the federal government was not inclined to look at it at all, because you may remember this was the time when U.S. attorneys were being dismissed around the country by the Justice Department for doing any cases that had any political import that was displeasing to the current administration. So the federal government was largely inert until the 2008 election. We wanted to create the idea of our character doing something and it just going to this frustrating wall. But at the same time, we were following the cases and as they went through court. Glover, I mean, these things were approaching court even as we were planning the season. We knew where Danziger was headed. We knew that we were going to have to resolve it over the course of the show. And our intention is to actually marry what actually happened in New Orleans to our fictional characters. And so we weren't willing to sort of rush it up or have a hero. And I know the other big discussion that happened in the writer's room was, look, you know, nothing happened until the administration's changed in November of 08. So nothing can happen in our show until we get to that point, because that would be dishonest. You can't credit the Justice Department with doing work they didn't do. Just because we have a civil rights lawyer in our character, she didn't break ground on any case. You know, she needed to wait for, you know, we didn't want to credit what we shouldn't credit. The David Morse character, who we made sort of a cop with some degree of conscience in the district, it wasn't the police that, there was no singular moment where a cop stood up and said, I'm not going to lie anymore. That didn't happen. We were really honest about, at least, let's credit the parts of society that worked here, and let's not credit, you know, and we have to work within those parameters. And again, that leads us to the reporter.
I should say, too, that the person Melissa Leo's character is inspired by, a lawyer named Mary Howell, who's been working in civil rights in New Orleans for decades, and she kept saying to us, you really should meet A.C. Thompson. He's doing this work, same, you know, this fictional case that you're doing, he's actually working on the real stuff. Maybe you should talk to him. And we started to think that Melissa Leo's character needed some help. We needed a journalist to enter the picture. So I suspect that was another reason we landed on the Glover case.
Right. If we were to bring an out-of-town reporter in, at a certain point, you may know this if you've tried this kind of storytelling, you know, unless he's going to talk to himself or you're going to use voiceover, he needs to learn. He just has to be somebody he can confide in. So the idea of a fellow traveler, a civil rights attorney who's working on the same type stuff, that allows the L.P. Everett character to explain, without it feeling like dreaded exposition, what his concerns are and what his theories are, and you can actually talk to somebody. Meanwhile, it allows her to bounce her kid. You know, all of a sudden the characters are strengthened by sort of the relationship.
I want to turn this over to our audience in just a second, but I want to ask one kind of basic question in this kind of writing for television or movies. Do you ever come to a point where you have, I mean, you talked about not wanting to give credit where it wasn't due, but when you're doing a story like this, what happens when the dramatic needs of the story do not intersect neatly with the real reality of it? Obviously, you're not doing documentaries. How do you, can you give an example of where you had to go, or maybe you don't, but you had to go for the heart of the drama as opposed to the facts? I don't know if that is applicable here, but maybe in something you've done either in Treme or the other stuff, because I think that would be helpful.
Let me do the one for that matches off of what AC just told you, which is AC's first tip on Henry Glover was from that, you called him a friend who said, there's this, been this complaint to this grassroots group about somebody who's killing somebody. We have 10 hours of television, and this is but one storyline in an ensemble drama. Television is an artifice. It's shorthand for anything that's real. So we made a couple of choices there. We did say you came originally, you know, you hear the character say, I came to look at this vigilante stuff. We see him at the coroner's office trying to get documents and being frustrated by the coroner's intransigence. And then we jump from there to, we got you into the neighborhood of Algiers talking to people. We had you go to the barbershop that you went to. But then we skipped that one beat. What we considered to be more important was, now he's in the neighborhood. Let's just see him go up and hear from the first witness about the shooting of this guy and hauling the body away looking for help. And we started the case from there. What we eliminated there was a fairly undramatic beat of, hey, I got a tip, there's this one-page report. Yeah, you know, I mean, on some level, just because it's true doesn't mean it ought to be in there. And that's, you know, that's kind of what, you know. On the other hand, don't veer out of it. And, you know, we didn't create some, you know, false way in which, but we just skipped the beat and had got him to the point of talking to the person who made that complaint, basically.
But do you ever get to the point in any of these stories where you actually are compelled to do something unreal? I mean, that's an interesting illustration, but it's not a fundamental divergence. I mean,
well, the whole fictional case in season two is a composite based on, it's realistic in that sense, but it never happened. It's a story of a cop shooting a young man who's inside a grocery store, looting essentially, or scavenging or whatever you want to call it. It's very much like a number of things that happened after the storm, but we made that up. We made up that character. We made up his father, who comes down to see what happened to his son and all that sort of thing.
We made up the grocery store.
Yeah, we made up.
Tried to use a real grocery store. Our lawyer said no. But I mean, we're making up stuff wholesale. I mean, I guess a good comparison. Somebody asked me a question about this on the way over, and I realized, although this is not television, a good comparison. Has anybody ever read any of the E.L. Doctorow books of historical fiction? You know, it's the Siege of Atlanta. It's Ragtime. It's you know, it's Billy Bathgate. It's wherever you wanna. It's Dutch Schultz for Billy Bathgate. The story is about the fictional characters, but he places them in the context of real history. He shows a real fealty to the time and place of history, and then he tells a completely fictional story that he wants to tell. And that's pretty much what we do, except instead of doing, you know, the Siege of Atlanta or Dutch Schultz, we're doing something happened 4 years ago. And we are using real names where we want to highlight that this really happened or that this guy really, like we use the real name of the real coroner in New Orleans because, you know, Frank Minyard should take responsibility for the system's failure that he created down there. And he's not fit to be a coroner or a medical examiner. So we used the real names, and we were very careful to say only what he did. I mean, you know, if you use a real name, you can't fictionalize anything. But there's other places where we made a guy up because we needed to.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is, you're not presenting, I think your way of describing it is good. You're telling a story and setting it in a real time and a real place. You're not holding yourself out. It's like we're giving you the literal chronicle of what happened.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, exactly. All right, questions. We have mics. And then there should be people in the audience with mics out there. How about right here, since you're close?
Thank you. I don't know if this is a question or a comment. You said you had about a two-month window to pitch your project. I'd argue that's about as long as the attention span of this country was regarding Katrina. I'd argue it was because I think this country had a certain amount of guilt about it. You said you lamented about how this series hasn't caught on the way it should, and I agree it should have caught on a lot more than it has. Why do you think that is? I personally think it's because we have a certain amount of guilt about Katrina.
Maybe. You know, You can't underestimate the number of people who came to New Orleans to help the rebuilding. Church groups, volunteer groups, and came for years, and they're still coming. I mean, not in such numbers, but I think the media has a short attention span. And there's always another calamity down the road. And people do get weary of one disaster and they move on. I have no idea if the country felt guilty about it. You know, I think there was a lot of genuine sympathy for New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast, the one that went through. And then the fatigue eventually sets in, you know, like, let's move on, get on with it. But really, there's something, I can't tell you how moved I've been by the people, the young people, not just young people, church groups, all kinds of volunteer groups, people who come down annually to get a house, and they're still doing it 5 years, 6 years, 7 years later. Right. Not everybody forgot about New Orleans. That's all I'm saying.
One of the themes that starts to emerge in season three of Tremé that I think is sort of elemental to what interested us about the story in the first place is all through the run, you see that the institutional imperative isn't there on the part of government, on the part of disaster capitalism is utterly sort of devoid of real connection to achieving anything. The police department doesn't work, the school system doesn't work. There's not all, these people are basically alone, which for us was allegorical about the country. I mean, I think 3 years later, an economic collapse, you know, a different kind of flood control proved not to be there, and we all sort of ended up having our New Orleans moment 3 years after Katrina. So there was a reason to do this that felt very much about the American experience, and the fact that the only things that seem to work for us right now are not our sort of political fundamentals and not our infrastructure and not all the things we thought were there that were part of our social and political compact. Community seems to work, and in New Orleans, culture works. The juxtaposition of culture and community and all these other problems that are besetting this community is intentional. Culture is the only weapon they have that's really sharp. And incredibly, in New Orleans, it proved to be enough. But we're very much enamored, I think, in the story of the individual ethos of people demanding community. And AC was an outsider who came down, very much like the people in the church groups. When you see that scene, and he's interviewing an out-of-town, a Virginia medical examiner that came down to do autopsies in the deluge after the storm and to do other post-mortem examinations. And that's how he found him. He found him back in Virginia after he had done this work. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of outreach on an individual level. And what FEMA was doing and what Halliburton was showing up to do and who got the big money and who ran away with it, that happened there. It then happened in Galveston. It happened in Haiti. It'll happen the next time. But individuals actually, you know, and not just on this storyline, but there's another storyline that's going on simultaneously about the housing scandal. Individual New Orleanians who started blogging about, you know, they're tearing down houses that are, you know, what are they doing? What's the plan? Where's the money coming from? What's going on? You know, that person today is running the local version of ProPublica in New Orleans, The Lens. And that process is depicted in season three. So there's a lot of season three that is about sort of, there's just us here. There's nobody but us. Either we argue for this community, either we assert for it, or, you know, it's just the day of the locust. So
AC, what was your involvement in the development of this storyline? Were you let into the process? Were you on the outside of the process? What was the experience like? And were you also a little terrified about having your character depicted in this show?
We had conversations. We had a conversation over dinner. And one thing you should know about these guys is they're kind of mysterious. They said, you should come to town and meet with us. And we had dinner and we talked. And it was an hour into dinner that they said, you know, we think we'd like you to consult on this show and maybe create a character modeled on you. And so the first hour, I was like, huh, wondering exactly what we're having a conversation, but I'm not totally sure where it's going, but we'll just, you know, figure it out. But anyway.
Isn't that your technique as a reporter? You don't go right at them with the questions right off the bat. Did you murder your wife? No, you get to establish a relationship.
I actually was thinking that. I was like, these guys are using journalistic methods to here.
It's actually the New Orleans way. You don't break any real ground until like the third moose bouche. You know?
So the really cool thing was to get to be involved with the incredible dramatists, these gentlemen, and the rest of the people in the writer's room, and to get to look at the scripts and to get to say, I don't think that works factually, and to overstep my boundaries and say, hey, I'd suggest doing this here, and hey, I'd suggest this dialogue and to be involved in that process. And that was, they occasionally did, and they didn't hold it against me when I made obnoxious suggestions like that, I don't think.
Actually, you were very clear on those moments where we were veering away from the reality in ways that were sort of damaging to the reality. And you were very forgiving of those moments that sort of didn't matter, that were sort of character moments. When people who were depicting and whose lives were sort of tangled, you know, I had a lot of this with Generation Kill, where we used the names of all those real Marines in First Recon. And you know, the vulnerabilities are you know, you're laid out there, it's your real name, and so you have to be extra careful and not make anything up. But there are people who handle the situation well, who basically have some degree of equipoise. I see where they're going with that. I see why that was short. And there are other people for whom it's a nightmare. Their reality is their reality. They're not wrong, but they're just not equipped to see anything fictionalized or anything left out or certain things included if those things are painful.
You know, David, this is a thing that I should ask you about that I encounter writing stories, is that there's the people that you write stories about and you try very hard to be very true to what you've seen with them. And you try very hard to tell their story well. And I have nightmares, people who come back and they say, hey, you didn't tell my story as truthfully as it should. I don't like the way you represented me. I don't like the way you told my story. And so having been on that side.
That's your nightmare?
Yeah, that's.
Do you have copy desk nightmares? Do you have those?
I have a few.
Do you know what the copy desk nightmare is?
Yeah.
Do you know? Are there reporters here? Has anybody had a copy desk nightmare? It's like a loose tooth nightmare for, you know. The copy desk nightmare is you wake up and you realize I made a mistake. You know, it's a fact, it's a figure, it's you did something wrong, you backwards wrote a sentence. And you call the copy desk in the nightmare and the slot man's left for the night. And then like usually you see the presses, you know, trucks. And I started having these in my 20s, and I still have an occasional copy desk, and I'm not even in the business anymore. So the idea of you actually confronting the people you've, because most mistakes are not malevolent. I've been, all of a sudden, in this latter stage of my life, I'm more interviewed than interviewing, suddenly, and most of the mistakes written about me are sort of sloppy and lazy, but they're not malevolent. You know, occasionally malevolent, but very, very rarely. Mostly it's just, I put two and two together and got five. And it's so easy to do, and it's so terrifying. Well, same thing for us when we are transposing reality and pulling it through our weird little keyhole. You know, we meant to shorten that to make it a little more dramatic without ruining it. And now we know we ruined it.
So for me, having had that experience that you've had where people are unhappy with how you portray them in your real life story, I just let go and I said, I'm not going to trip about where the character goes. I've been on the other side and writing people's stories and worried really a whole lot about getting it right. And this is a fictional character. Relax. Let go. Let's see where he goes, what he does. I don't have to even worry about it. It was liberating and really enjoyable, actually, to see where the character went and what he did. And that's what was great. I didn't have to...
That's a function of your healthy personality. I'll tell you an alternate story, which is on homicide, which I didn't do homicide. I was, you know, I later went to work for the show after it was an established thing. I learned to do television by working on that show. But in the first season, I stood around the set one day because it was cool. It was like this weird stepchild of a book I wrote. I came to my town and, you know, let's go watch the circus. And in the first season, they hired the original detectives who were in the book to be consultants. And they all divided it up among the detectives. Some of them were okay as consultants. And others just wanted to have their picture taken with the actors or the actresses. And Harry Edgerton was on set. He was the real-life model for Pembleton, for Andre Brower's character. And one day, the scene called for, I was on set, Andre Brower walks into a bar in Fells Point and orders a milk, a glass of something, and then a glass of milk as a chaser. And it was the pilot, because Barry Levinson was directing. And Harry's sitting there next to the sort of video village, and he sees the milk put down, and he yelled, cut. Honest, true story.
Film students out there, do not do that.
So I have a question for AC.
All right, good.
When you're looking at how to reach an audience, and ProPublica tries to reach audiences through all sorts of platforms, but all nonfiction and journalistic, so what do you think about the power of fiction and getting some of the messages across that you were so passionate about as you pursued this story? How does it compare to nonfiction? Do you think you're going to reach a different sort of audience, a bigger? What do you think about that?
I think, honestly, the thing that's most interesting to me about fiction is the ability to deal with what we don't deal with in journalism, which is we generally don't deal with people's internal motivations and the things that propel them and the psychology behind their actions. We generally don't get a chance to peer into people's minds like that in nonfiction. And actually, that's a thing that I really appreciate about a show like this, is to be able to follow that a little bit more. As well, the ability to communicate these messages that have been really well articulated here tonight, and to be able to talk about this story again, and to talk about this storyline again to a different audience that may not have seen our documentary, may not have seen these stories, and will get it in a different way, is a really, really interesting, very, very cool thing for me to be a part of. And it's really exciting for me. I think drama has a way to resonate with people, sometimes in ways that a documentary or a news story just simply don't. And that's just the truth of the matter.
I should have mentioned this earlier. You were interviewed in connection with this, with the documentary that Spike Lee did. Can you elaborate about the distinction between that experience and this? I mean, is there anything from that that's worth sharing with our, particularly our students out here?
Yeah, well, that was pretty, that was very, very cool too. What I remember about that is talking about Arsenal and soccer with Spike, which was pretty cool. You know, in that case, it's a totally different scenario because you've got to be on point and get every fact right and phrase everything. Try to be eloquent, which for me is a challenge at times. And with this, it was a thing where we could sort of talk through the story and then sort of brainstorm and see and talk about facts. And I could, the writer's room called me and said, did the coroner's office do this at this time? Did this happen with the police at this time? And we could have those kind of very technical discussions. But there was also the whole fictional element to it that was totally different. So it was a completely different experience. And you realize that doing the Spike documentary, you're going to be communicating to an HBO audience that is perhaps very different than the audience that's going to tune into Tremé. You know, it's a different platform, a whole different deal.
Right. Anybody in the back? Yeah, Dan.
David, you said before that when you depict real people, you have to depict what they actually did. And then AC, you just said that the interesting thing about drama is that you get the opportunity to really see people's motivation behind what they're doing. And so my question is, how do you find that balance when you're fictionalizing somebody? Because you're taking a real person and you're assigning them a motivation. What kind of burden does that put on you as a writer?
Well, I'm sorry, I may have been confused, or I may have confused you rather. What I was saying, I think I was in a reference to Generation Kill, or I guess you could also say The Corner. Those two projects, we used the real names of the actual people. One of the reasons he became L.P. Everett was we didn't know at the beginning of the season if we're going to have him drunk off his ass flying from a trapeze, at some rock and roll venue, you know, just because we wanted to, just because it was fun. We didn't know if he's going to end up, you know, screwing every waitress for three episodes. We don't. What we're doing with the interior dialogue of this reporter character, we didn't know. So rather than tie him, you know, once you call him A.C. Thompson, you know, there's a responsibility there. So if I'm depicting somebody who's based on somebody, like, you know, I don't worry if Tony Burnett is in any way different from Mary Howe, the civil rights attorney on which we based, you know, we based a generalized concept of what Mary Howe does and her place in the community and how she would do stuff. And we asked Mary questions about process and about her thoughts about, you know, this guy or that guy, or how she perceives the police department. And that stuff we all use. That's grist for our mill. Then we write the character as a fictional character. We make it up. Tony Burnett's a made-up character. And then Melissa Leo comes along, and she adds Melissa Leo choices to the character, something that we can't even control as the writer. So ultimately, once you let a character into that world, there's a certain responsibility. What I was speaking of is Generation Kill. You really can't make stuff up. If you're going to call that guy Colbert and that guy Ray Person, that's the names of the two Marines who were in the lead Humvee going into Baghdad. And so I owe it to Ray Person not to make anything up if I want him to be Ray Person. So that, there was much more rigor, and that's what I was saying. That rigor doesn't exist for a character. As it turned out, the great joke here, I have to say, I'm going for it. You want to tell it?
let me tell you now, let me make you tough. There was this one sort of personal idiosyncrasy that we where we had this sort of moment of, was a hilarious synthesis. Was
this? Did you really wait?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, are you sure? Okay, so I get a script, and there's a character who's talking about a band from New Orleans called Goat Whore. And he says, Goat Whore are the new Black Sabbath. Well, in fact, I actually had Goat Whore on my iPhone at that time, and I was listening to their album, which is really aggressive. It's kind of like a cross between Carcass, Slayer, and Obituary, if you're familiar with any of these.
For those of you keeping score at home.
With a little Norwegian black metal thrown in. And so I sent a note to the writer's room. I said, Goat Whore do not sound like Black Sabbath at all. They don't sound anything like that. This is what they sound like. They're fast, they're this, they're that. And I said, if you want to describe them like this. And I said, there are bands in New Orleans that sound like Black Sabbath, and here's some bands. And so that ended up being something that got incorporated into the...
But what we said was, we made up the fact that your character liked metal. Do you like metal? That was one moment of, I don't know what to make of that moment.
We're coming to the end here, so I'm only going to be able to take a couple more questions. Since I haven't gotten anybody in the back, I'll take that person right there in the back. Then we'll try to get this person who's been raising his hand very conscientiously up here. And I'm afraid that might be it. But go ahead.
All right. Hi. I guess my question is about language. And definitely in The Wire, there were moments where I needed to turn on subtitles to truly understand every single word that was being said. But this question is about Treme, and my question is, like, how do you guys work with the actors and as writers to get at a language and a dialect which you don't necessarily are, or which isn't yours?
Well, we've both spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and I think we have a good ear. That's one of the things I love about New Orleans is the way people talk. And there are about 99 official New Orleans accents by statistical count. And what we didn't want to do was have the bad Southern accent or the bad Cajun accent. So anybody who comes in, we say to them, the actors, all the day players, just talk like you talk. Don't put on anything for us. And people in New Orleans, the natives, they have a fabulous way of talking and a sort of language all their own. So we've just taken advantage of that. We'd be fools to get in between Dr. John and any piece of dialogue. And there are a lot of people, or Coco Robichaud, there are a lot of characters in New Orleans like that. We listen and we make notes and people give us things, but mostly it's just listening and asking people to be themselves and not some idea of a Cajun or a Scarlett O'Hara.
One of the traditions you have in all these shows is that you do tend to use a lot of, when you can, local actors. So that, I'm sure, helps in that situation too. Yeah.
This is a question for AC. I'm wondering if you had any interactions with Picayune reporters while you were down there, and what you think the future investigative landscape looks like in New Orleans now that there's not a daily paper.
So that's a great question. You know, my early reporting I did largely on my own. And as I went along, I teamed up with the Picayune, with Gordon Russell, Laura Maggi, Brendan McCarthy, and with reporters from PBS Frontline, Sabrina Shankman, Tom Jennings, and others, and worked collaboratively. And all those people deserve a huge shout out. And so I worked with all those people, and we all did things together that we couldn't have done if we weren't working as a team. I think David has commented on this a fair amount, that New Orleans, more than any other city perhaps in America, needs a very aggressive, very vigorous watchdog media. Things get absolutely out of control in that wonderful city, got absolutely out of control even when they had a daily paper with a decent sized staff. So the more you slash staff, the more you cut those resources, the more you take reporters who've been around for years off the beat and take them away from their ability to watchdog the city and make sure that judges aren't taking bribes, that police officers aren't taking bribes, that other public officials aren't engaged in just epic level corruption, the more you're going to have a troubled city. I'm heartened by things like The Lens, which is a sort of mini ProPublica nonprofit journalism startup in New Orleans. I'm heartened by the bloggers who've gone after stories and actually done reportage there. But I'm worried about that city, and you should jump in.
I think until there's a revenue stream established online for professional journalism, every city has to worry. Every city, every major American city has seen cutbacks. In Baltimore, they're down to about 120 people at the Sun. When I was there, I guess if you include the zone sections, they were up at about 550. And there's a fundamental there, which is this is a problem. And you must find a market for it, and you must have a revenue stream, because ProPublica is an absolute good, and A.C. Thompson's work is an absolute good, but he's not in New Orleans now. And you may go back for a single story, but how you actually cover a city is through a beat structure. And you actually have to cover it institutional. Somebody has to show up every morning, and they have to go to the courthouse or city hall or the school board or the zoning board, and they got to figure out what's going on, what's actually going on, and they have to work sources, and they have to do that every day of their careers. Until you establish a revenue stream that can pay for that, you know, everything else is sort of desperate and incremental. I don't believe that, you know, 1,000 points of Blogger Lite are going to pick up the slack for what is a job. It's a profession. And until you can pay people enough to, you know, pay their mortgages and send their kids to college and do it for their lives, something is going out of American civic life, and it's very dangerous. I think the good news is that we're at the end of the beginning. And if you look at what the New York Times has accomplished in a very short span of time with its paywall and with its subscription base, they're making real money, and they're looking at going back into the black within, I think, something like 9 or 10 months from now. That may be the end of the beginning, and you needed to see the high tier of journalism do it and say, no, 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 we're going to do this, we're going to provide what we used to provide, but we need to create a revenue stream for it. And that was the great mistake 15, 20 years ago, was giving it away for free. It was as much contempt as an industry can have for its own product. You know, when things started to go bad, they just cut the product. So now you're going online with stuff that isn't even as strong as it once might have been. But ultimately, we're all going to end up paying for news that we need online. We're going to pay less than we would have paid to have it thrown on our doorstep. You know, we're going to pay $9.95 a month, $10.95, but we're going to pay. And in doing that, we're going to preserve the profession, and the profession's going to get around to doing what it needs to do, and that is staff these beats in every community in America and be that bulwark against institutional excess.
Well, listen, one thing I want to say, and I don't want this to sound like a commercial, but first of all, thank the both of you for doing a very special, needed kind of television. And I have to say, thank HBO for being willing to put this kind of show, even though it's not getting super duper ratings on the air, and supporting it, and so there's hope out there for you students that if you do have something special and it's distinctive, there are outlets that will support it. Unfortunately, right now it's happening more in television than in film.
What a plausible outcome. You know, guide yourself accordingly.
And then I want to thank you, AC, for doing a tremendous job and for really getting to the bottom of a really horrible situation and bringing it to light. And I want to thank all you guys. Thank you.
That was AC Thompson, David Simon, Eric Overmeyer, and Joe Piccirillo. For more information on the Law and Disorder series, visit propublica.org/NOLA. NOLA. And watch HBO's Treme every Sunday to see how the fictionalized version plays out. And now for our official Say the Darndest Things Tumblr quote of the week. You could have smoked that lettuce, and you still end up with the same problems. It is the smoke that kills, not the nicotine. Who said that? Former Congressman Steve Beyer, in his infamous 2009 speech on the benefits of smokeless tobacco. Beyer is now a lobbyist for tobacco giant R.J. Reynolds. Okay, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll catch you next time.